Welcome, everyone. Welcome to the Yahoo Fantasy Baseball Podcast. It is our final edition of the 2020 baseball season. I am your host, Scott Pianowski. It is Tuesday, October 28th. This crazy baseball tournament is about to kick off. And, of course, we just wrapped a very exciting and different fantasy season, a roughly 60-game schedule for most teams. And I thought it was good to get conversation in with one of my oldest friends in the industry. You probably know Derek Van Riper from, if not his days at RotoWire, you know him at The Athletic, where he does a little bit of everything. He's a producer, he's a writer, podcast host, got one of the best voices in the industry, and just has a lot of intelligent things to say. Good guy. And we're going to be talking baseball takeaways today, baseball stuff, fantasy. We'll preview this tournament a little bit if we have time. And then at the end of it, we'll do a draft of Wisconsin athletes because Derek is from the great state of Wisconsin. Enough of my talking. Hello, Mr. Van Riper.
Hey, Scott. Thanks for having me on. It's great to catch up with you.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. And, well, it's just a really strange season, 2020. Other than the size of it, there were teams that had prolonged absence of play. The Marlins didn't play for a while. The Cardinals didn't play for a while. I know you've had a successful season because you won the Tout Wars Mixed League, and you pretty much a juggernaut in that season, seemed like all year. We'll go through some of your individual players later and maybe some takeaways with them. But was your strategy different in 2020? What we try to identify takeaways. This is such an unusual year. I'm really careful with takeaways and even takeaways in general. Just because something just happened that was important that moved the needle, it doesn't mean that it necessarily applies to the coming season. But when I say takeaways for fantasy baseball this season, what comes to mind?
I think the first one is the impact of universal DH, because it was one of the few strategies that I actually adjusted for the unique season. And typically in a mixed league, I'm going pretty heavy with NL pitchers because I want that path to slightly better ratios. I think it's something that gets a little bit overlooked in a typical year. And I think as predicted, things played out in a way where the two leagues were even with the universal DH. I mean, that wasn't rocket science, but it was definitely one of those things that you had to adjust. You had to change your expectations and either lower your NL pitchers or boost your AL pitchers. And if you look at my rosters compared to a typical year, you know, you're going to see a lot of flyers on guys that, frankly, I would have ordinarily avoided. So I think that was something that really changed for me this year, that in years past wouldn't have been as aggressive going with AL pitchers in particular. But I think, you know, one thing that I also tried to do this season was look past some of the concerns I would have had about an older player over a full 162 durability concerns. Those to me were much less of an issue in a 60-game sprint, right? Because every team had a path to the postseason, at least theoretically. And the bumps and bruises that pile up on guys who are in the later part of their career, those were less of a concern for me. So old and boring was a bigger part of my strategy than usual. I think there's usually value there, but I was more aggressive and more willing to take on a larger share of a roster that had a pretty ugly injury history or durability concerns, because I didn't think those would play out nearly as much in a season that was only 60 games long.
Do you think the universal DH is here to stay? What do you think they'll do next year?
I think they are going to bring it back again next year. I hope it's here for the future and indefinitely. I don't like watching pitchers hit. I don't really know a lot of people who do. And, you know, it makes our game more fun. It opens up a few jobs for guys that would ordinarily be squeezed out of the league. You know, maybe we get one more season of a guy like Ryan Braun if the universal DH stays around. If it doesn't, maybe he doesn't really fit in the league anymore. At least he doesn't fit in the National League at this stage of his career. So I'm hoping we see it going forward, and I'm optimistic they're going to get that right.
Now, in some of the industry leagues that we play in, a lot of them for years have just been weekly transactions. You make those offers on Sunday, you apply those players on Monday. Now, the NFBC has a different setup where they have twice a week transactions, and you can swap out your hitters on Friday. The Friends and Family League that we run in Yahoo is a daily transaction league, but we limit the amount of pickups you're allowed to make. All these different formats, obviously DFS is part of the picture too. Do you feel there's a cadence that you prefer? That everybody has to answer this question for themselves, but I mean, if it's up to you, what is the right transaction cadence? What do you feel makes for the best game?
I think twice a week is probably the most balanced for maintaining a normal life, living in the central time zone. Lineup lock every day is usually around dinner time, and it's really inconvenient to kind of drop what you're doing as you're going about that part of your day to double check and make sure in a daily situation that everybody's good to go. Doing that twice a week affords you enough flexibility where if you lose someone early in the week, you know, you're not stuck with them for 4 or 5 days before you can replace them. The one thing I want more leagues to do, and maybe it's a programming nightmare, we have it in Tout Wars, but the midweek injury swap is, I think, kind of a happy medium sort of scenario, right? Because I totally understand why some people want to play daily, you know, set the lineups in advance, grind out platoons, mix and match players. You know, there's some benefit to that, of course. But the happiest medium is being able to pull out the injured player midweek or return an injured player midweek and then let it play out from there. And you don't have that obligation of 7 days a week of adjusting your roster for 26 weeks. This year, in the shortened season, I felt like, as a commissioner, I was obligated to increase the number of moves, make it a daily league if it was previously a weekly league, because it wasn't fair. We had no idea what this season was going to be like. We had no idea how many cases of COVID we were going to have or how many players were going to be opting out. And I think when you have uncertainty, you want to add flexibility. I guess I'm optimistic that 2021 can't be worse than 2020. And with that, I'm hoping we can get back into more normal rhythms with how we played fantasy baseball. But twice a week is the sweet spot for me.
This has been a common theme on this podcast, so I apologize to our regular listeners because we have gone over this, but I certainly want to get Derek's take on it. We saw more relief wins than ever before, more safe striation. I mean, Tampa Bay, it feels like they just want a different guy to close out every one of their wins. And, of course, they won 40 games, but last I checked, they had 12 different pitchers who got a save. So it feels like you need fewer and fewer saves and stolen bases to compete. Did you adjust your strategy, whether it was preseason or during the season on the fly? Just give us a sense of where we're at going forward with save and stolen base strategy.
Yeah, saves, I did adjust on the fly. I tried to get two closers in most mixed leagues. If I missed, a lot of times that second closer was Will Smith. I didn't believe the Braves that Mark Melancon was going to close. I thought Will Smith would be back early enough in the year from his bout with COVID that he was going to take over that job. They paid him enough money. Why wouldn't he be the closer? So in all the places where I was wrong, I didn't worry about throwing large chunks of fab at replacements. I feel like they're bad investments on the waiver wire. I think you're better off getting lucky with a $1 to $3 endgame second closer than trying to pay up for two elite ones because it can still go wrong on you. Guys get hurt like Kirby Yates did this year. Sometimes performance falls off a cliff. I mean, Edwin Diaz last year and this year was a nightmare, looking really good at times, looking terrible at other times. So I've really gone to the point where I just want one closer I trust. I'll take a flyer on draft day, on auction day, trying to get that second one. And if I don't find someone cheap on the wire, I'm not overspending for those saves because you're right. Everything was so clustered together this year. It just didn't make sense when you could get so much more in the other pitching categories by chasing two-star pitchers or even just being aggressive with the quality starting pitchers that became available.
And I think another big part of that strategy, I said before the season, last year I was proactive to get Nick Anderson after he popped. And he was good with the Marlins. He kind of took it up to another level when he went to Tampa Bay, but the strikeout rate was always there. And I make the point that, look, nobody thought anything of Nick Anderson before last year. He had kind of an interesting life, meandering, you know, some problems off the field. Everything lined up for him last year. He got his stuff going. These relievers, they come in, they're only pitching a lot of times an inning. You know, throw 20 pitches with your hair on fire and then get out of there, although some of these guys might pitch multiple innings. But so my goal this year was like, okay, I want to try to rather than pay up for Nick Anderson on draft day, I want to find the next Nick Anderson. And I didn't get this guy anywhere close to universal. I invited too many Brewer fans into my leagues. But you look at the year Devin Williams had in, he might be the National League Rookie of the Year. I mean, his stats are straight out of wiffle ball in your backyard. 27 innings, he struck up 53 guys, 0.33 ERA, 0.63 whip. He picked up 4 wins, which I think speaks to the starting pitchers just going fewer and fewer innings and teams being proactive. Like, look, we want to win this game. We get a 3-1 lead in the fifth inning. Let's get Williams in here, step on their throat for a couple innings and put this game away. And when the Brewers were trying to get in the playoffs, they really, I thought, got turbo aggressive with Williams. Just give us the thought, you know, watching him up close as a big Brewers fan that you are, would he be somebody that you say, okay, I think he's discovered something, I'll go after him next year? Or do we just try to find the next Williams? Just to talk about the Williams experience for 2020.
I'm really curious to see where people draft him, but he's been probably the most fun player to watch on that team. Corbin Burns has been fantastic this year, too, and it's really disappointing that he's going to miss at least the wild card series with the Dodgers. If you throw Burns and Woodruff out there with Hader and Williams in the bullpen, the Brewers can hang with anybody in a best of three series, right? But I think having to bullpen it and then turn it over to those guys is going to be a little bit tricky. With Williams, if he's going in the top 150 overall, I'm trying to think where Nick Anderson was going, probably around there before we even really knew what the Rays were going to do with saves. I don't think that makes sense for a non-closer reliever. I didn't have Nick Anderson anywhere this year, so I'm more inclined to find the next one. The only reason it might be different is because I could see them kind of splitting up save opportunities between Williams and Hader. I think the gap between them skills-wise is basically zero. I think you can make an argument that Devin Williams might be better than Josh Hader at this point, if you look at the underlying skills. So part of it is that you have to look at this team and say, are they going to be flexible enough to split the role between two relievers? I think they could, because they've mixed and matched a bit before with Hader, before they made Hader the closer. It was Corey Knebel. It was Jeremy Jeffress for a year. So I think this is a team that's more of a tinkering team than most, and that could open the door for Williams, but more likely than not, I'm looking for the next one simply because everyone's going to chase those ratios, everyone's going to chase the sky-high strikeout rate, and he's going to be cost-prohibitive in our 2021 drafts.
It's funny. If you would just block the save column out and you had showed the Williams stats and the Hader stats and said to somebody who maybe was, you know, out of the country or didn't follow baseball for a year but was conversant in baseball, okay, which guy was Hader, which guy was somebody else, you would think, oh, yeah, Hader must be the guy with the ERA, you know, under one and in the crazy whip. I mean, Hader, for his standards, actually had, I think, a disappointing year. I mean, 0.95 whip is terrific, but his ERA was 3.79. Strikeouts 31 in 19 innings for Hader. I think that's a little bit of a step back, and it's not unusual. I mean, like, it's great when relievers have really long runs of relevance, but it's not unusual for that to be a high variance position year in, year out. Sometimes it's a case of muscle memory. You know, I don't think I'm going to have Devin Williams next year, and if he's great again, I'll regret that. But I just feel like it's a tried and true thing. In April, just look for the guy with two walks and 13 strikeouts and pick him up. I know, you know, that's not always going to work, and there's going to be some misses there. But okay, you can usually quickly identify who you want to walk away from. I just feel like that until the market gets a little bit more proactive in that way, I feel like it's just giving you this stuff for almost for free.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I think the other thing is, I watch both of these guys this season that really stands out to me, though, is the difference in command. Josh Hader does not have good or consistent command. He comes into a start and you see him throwing pitches a foot above the top of the zone. You see him occasionally bouncing the slider. Like, when he's commanding the slider, he's untouchable. But it's kind of a coin flip as to whether or not he's going to command it or not command it on any given day. With Williams, there's a lot more consistency with that command. And it's not just the screwball, changeup, airbender, whatever you want to call it. It's paint with the fastball, too. It's inside, it's up, it's on the corners. Anywhere he needs that fastball, he seems to locate it really well, and then he comes back with just an untouchable changeup. So I think, you know, Williams, to me, looks like he's got the brighter future right now as well, too. We know relievers burn out pretty fast. Maybe we've already seen the best of Josh Hader, and he could still have a handful of really good years left, but I actually see Hader as a guy who's clearly in decline at this point, even if it's going to be a somewhat graceful one from a strikeouts perspective.
We'll get to totally approved victory lap of your Tout Wars team. I mean, you finished the season first with 119.5 points. Jeff Zimmerman, 105.5, came in second place. And if you look far and wide down the standings, you'll see my team with 67.5 points. So I was not really in the running this year. And I wrote down a couple of the key players you had. And you already mentioned maybe reasons why you might have ended up with Kenta Maeda, Nelson Cruz. And I'm kicking myself for not having more Maeda. I always liked him on the Dodgers. And I think because the Dodgers have always been proactive about getting him out of the game really quickly, it seems like a lot of times he's a 4, 5, 6 inning pitcher. I know that's an increasing trend in baseball. I was maybe concerned that he'd be high quality innings, but maybe the wins wouldn't be there. And now everything looks easy once the games are played. But I look and, geez, the Tigers, the Royals, the Pirates, in a season where you only played Central Division opponents. At one point, I did all the OP. I looked at all the OPSs of the Central Division teams, and they were lagging behind every other division, and it wasn't even close. It felt like there's – I mean, I know the White Sox have a good lineup, and there are a couple of other teams here who had decent offenses. But I felt like this was a sweet spot to be in. And I should have seen this coming, and I got almost nothing out of it. Talk about what your stance was with Maeda this year, and you know, was it proactive? And again, universal DH, and moving to the American League isn't the step back that normally it would have been.
Right. I think even we did Tout Wars back before we knew what was going on with COVID and the baseball schedule. I liked him even before it was all central. And part of the reason is that I believe that the Twins handle pitching maybe as well as any organization in the league right now. They're not on the same plane in the minds of most people, like as say like the Dodgers or the Astros or Cleveland, but I think they have a case along with Cincinnati to be inside that top five. Wes Johnson's done a phenomenal job as their pitching coach. I'm still waiting for him to, you know, work a little more magic and get Jose Berríos up to ace status, but I'll probably have a lot of Berríos again in 2021 for some of these reasons. I don't think the Tigers are going to be a lot better offensively next year. I don't think the Royals are going to be a lot better offensively next year. So you're going to have a few soft landing spots in division for Twins pitchers. But with Maeda, I kept coming back to this. The Twins, no team has depth like the Dodgers. The Twins certainly didn't have pitching depth to the extreme of the Dodgers. So the games that the Dodgers could play with Maeda late in the season, which were probably more about his waning effectiveness and less about the incentives in his contract, the Twins didn't really have that option. Like, they were going to go into August and September needing Kenta Maeda to pitch every fifth day. And even if they shortened him up, kept him from going six plus, if he was going five and change more often, you know, he was still going to be eligible for wins given that sort of setup. So I just thought everything looked really good for him. You know, going NL to AL, it's not always a great scenario. This was about as good as it could be with him landing in Minnesota. Always believed in the skills. You look at his splits against righties. I mean, K rate over 30%, I think 3+ years running. So really it was a question of, could he get better against lefties? I didn't think he had to return value where he was going. I think the question now is, if he's going to go in the top 60 overall, probably the first four rounds of most drafts going into 2021, is that an overcorrection in the other direction? Are you willing to pay a premium for Maeda going into next season?
Totally fair question. It's actually a lot of Twins on this roster and guys I want to ask you about. Let's talk about Nelson Cruz. He hit the most home runs in the 2010s, but a player who is just utility in most leagues. That's less of a penal thing in a universal DH, although when you originally bought Cruz, we didn't know that universal DH would be an issue. Twins don't play that many games in National League parks anyway, but I guess this is the David Ortiz career path. I mean, Ortiz never really had a bad season. He eventually just retired. I get nervous watching. Eventually, everybody, you would think, shows age. I mean, look what's going on in the football season right now, where Brady and Breeze don't look anywhere near their former selves. They're not bad players. They're not embarrassing themselves. But, you know, when I'm filling out a DFS lineup, I'm not looking to play Tom Brady or Drew Breeze anymore. Cruz just had another monster season. What do you do with a guy who's almost in uncharted territory? Again, you could compare him to Ortiz, but he's going to be 41 years old next year. You know, what's the Cruz approach for next season?
He's going to be discounted again relative to the projections because of the reasons you mentioned, and he should be because the wheels are going to fall off eventually, right? Like, who plays into their early 40s at this level? There were a couple of signs of decline, very small ones. The K rate ticked up again this season, 27.1%. He was up at 25.1% in 2019. And I got to think the batting average falls apart, right? I mean, back-to-back years where he's hit over 300, that can't continue. And I didn't draft him expecting 300 and the power. I expected 260 and the power and above average run production because of the quality of the lineup around him in Minnesota. I look at Cruz in kind of the same bucket skills wise as maybe JD Martinez right now. And Martinez is what, 8 years younger? To me, JD is the much smarter 2021 buy, even though Cruz has put together just a ridiculous run in the back half of his 30s. I didn't see this coming. If you think back to Nelson Cruz in Texas, you know, dealing with hamstring injuries and not being a very patient hitter, he would have been nowhere near the top of my list of a player who is still going to be good as he passed age 40.
Right. I mean, the question for him a few years ago was that, oh, well, he was great in Texas, he was great in Baltimore, but good luck in Seattle. It's, you know, it's not a great place for a righty power hitter, and you know, the park didn't hold him back there. Minnesota, a lot closer to neutral, but the people, you know, I remember people used to say, oh, CeCe Sabathia, he's thrown all these innings, he's going to break down at some point. It's like, well, yeah, you'll be right at one point, but you'll probably be broke because you've lost money on him the previous seven seasons. I feel like Nelson Cruz is that guy. It's funny you mentioned JD Martinez. I didn't have him on the script today, but he's a really difficult guy to figure out. Because remember, he was openly critical of all the changes and reform with video and what the league will allow you to do now between at bats. He had a horrible season. I knew the Red Sox were going to be bad. And I said before the season that you're going to want streaming against these guys and they're going to have a horrible ERA. But I thought the offense would still be good. And yeah, a few guys had good seasons. A lot of guys didn't. I had some Benintendi shares, which totally crashed and burned. And Martinez was probably one of the most disappointing players in the 2020 fantasy season. What do you think is a reasonable ADP or just area for him to be drafted next year? It sounded like you were open-minded to it. What's the stance on Martinez right now?
I think he's going to go probably in the 80 to 100 range overall. I mean, once you account for, I think he's UT only going into the season, the market always discounts these players, even though I think we've realized that if you have multi-position eligible guys elsewhere, filling the UT spot, clogging the UT spot's not as much of a detriment as we used to believe. I mean, look at the core skills. This is a guy that is every year a threat to hit 300 and brings big power to the table. The plate skills didn't completely fall apart. I didn't think the lineup would be this bad either. Bogaerts is back. Devers is back. They still have Verdugo there. It's a good enough lineup around him for them to kind of prop him up to be another, I don't know, 390-90 sort of season with big power. And there's obviously room for more than that, too. They could also add something. It's going to be a depressed free agent market by every indication. So if the Red Sox allow Chaim Bloom to spend a little bit of money, they could patch a couple of holes and they could actually be quite a bit better offensively than they were in 2020. So I think even if that pitching staff's still a disaster, the offense should play up a bit. Now, the question about the in-game video is one that I think a lot of players are struggling with. Like, what are we going to do with guys that have great track records who fell apart? You can count Javi Baez as part of this, too. I think he's been pretty openly critical of these changes. Are they going to find some way to get whatever it is that they were using that video for and kind of have that ready to roll, whether that's someone on the coaching staff kind of reviewing the video with them ahead of the game? I mean, there's got to be some workaround for players who are missing that video, right? It just seems really weird to me that we're in an era in which players can't adjust to that change.
I agree with you. I mean, the old school thing would be that the leadoff hitter, the number two hitter, would come back to the bench and give you a report, you know, he's doing this with the slider. You know, he's throwing this curveball in this spot. And advanced scouting was a big part of the mix. And we know a lot of teams have gone away from their scouting departments and they've cut them out significantly. Martinez is too young, too smart, and I think too talented not to have a bounce back. So I'm probably going to be proactive in drafting him next year. Mention another guy you had on the Twins who had a real look, Byron Buxton. I feel like his career has touched all different areas. When he came into baseball, he wasn't a prospect. He was the prospect. He was, you know, the cover boy, the number one, you know, probably on the cover of Baseball America at one point when the prospects book. And he's done a little bit of everything. He's had years where he couldn't do anything right. He's got hurt a lot. He's played a lot of good defense. He's had as many as 29 stolen bases in a season, being caught just once. At times, he's improved his OBP skills to get, you know, to like 314 range, which isn't so terrible when he can do a lot of other things. He had a very strange year this year. First of all, he didn't play in about two-thirds of the season, or one-third of the season, I should say. But in 39 games, he still hit 13 home runs. He slugged 577, and hit for in a 5x5 league, a very acceptable 254. Now, you had him in tout, which is OBP. He didn't walk at all, so his OBP was only 267, and he totally shut down the running game. He attempted 3 stolen bases all season into an age 27 season next year. I feel like I've been in on Buxton. I've been out on Buxton. I've been proactive on Buxton. I've been hands-off on Buxton. I feel like his career has taken so many different shapes. But what I can't miss here is that 577 is a great slugging percentage. And obviously, I know what you're on pace for through 39 games can often be meaningless, but he hit 13 home runs in 39 games. I mean, this was going to be a 40 or 50 home run season in a full year if he could maintain something close to that. But yet he stopped running. Where the heck are we at these days on Byron Buxton?
I am so confused by his season. I loved Buxton coming into the season. I think it was first pitch Arizona going into 2019. So right off that disappointing 2018, somebody was on the platform and they asked the room, probably 150 people in the room, show of hands, who's drafting Byron Buxton at pick 150 to 200 this year? And I think I had my hand up and one other person had their hand up. And it didn't necessarily work out in 2019, but I had the same principle going to 2020 because I saw underlying growth after more injuries last year. The exit velocity was up. The walk rate was up. The K rate was down. Those are all good things. And a lot of Buxton's injuries are more of the accident variety, like collisions with the wall. Okay, there's like a reckless approach that Buxton has. He goes all out playing gold glove defense. He's going to hit some walls sometime. He's got to scale back on that a little bit if he's going to stay healthy. But, you know, getting hit by a pitch or hurting your wrist after something like that or jamming your thumb sliding. There's some bad luck sprinkled into that aggressive approach too. So I'm looking at him and I see a guy that keeps getting better with the exception of the walk rate cratering this year. That's the most troubling thing about a year that went right for him. He walked 1.5% of the time this season. And he's never been really patient, but that was one part of his game that I thought was kind of trending in the right direction a year ago. But this is all a long way of saying there's still more good than bad in this profile. 99th percentile in sprint speed. So he's going to get green lights when he's not hitting home runs. He's not going to hit home runs at that pace, even though the exit velocity numbers and hard hit rates back it up. 85th percentile in exit velo, so 89th percentile in hard hit rate. It's not fluky that he has power. It's just fluky that he had that much power in such a small sample. I still see more of like a 20 homer, 35 steal sort of peak season for him. He's reminded me of Carlos Gomez for
Carlos
years.
Carlos Gomez. I was just thinking that, right? Exact just same player, really.
So athletically gifted, a great defensive center fielder. The power's real. The speed is incredible. And it took Gomez a really long time to get to that peak where he was a multi-year sort of first-round fantasy player. And it fell apart pretty quickly. And I think you could see it following the exact same arc for Buxton for so many reasons. Coincidentally, yeah, both Twins. The Twins gave up on Gomez pretty quickly, but I'm still in on Buxton, and he's another guy where I say, what's the price going to be? Like, what are people going to comfortably pay for the season that Byron Buxton just gave us here in 2020?
You know, I haven't done a deep dive and gotten granular with some of his approaches in certain counts or what his chase rate was and stuff, but I also think there's at least a case to be made. I'd be curious if this would be borne out in a statistical dive, and I'll try to do it later, or I'll just wait till like somebody like Jeff Zimmerman does it, or you know, Saras, and I'll just copy off them. But sometimes being aggressive is a good thing. You know, what's more frustrating than when you see somebody who's really patient and they take a meatball fastball down the plate for strike one? It's like, that might be the best pitch you got to hit. I wonder if this home run surge was maybe him just saying, look, I don't care. I'm going to strike out. I'm not going to walk. But if I get my pitch, I'm going to drive it out of the park.
Yeah, and it's kind of weird. If you look at the breakdown, fastballs versus breaking balls versus off speed for those 13 home runs, 7 of those 13 home runs came against breaking balls. I would have expected him to be ambushing fastballs with that approach.
Sure.
And that wasn't really the case at all. The underlying numbers for him against fastballs, which again, splits on pitch types in 162 games are pretty small. I mean, do that for less than 60 games, and I'm not sure you have a whole lot to fall back on, but he did not handle fastballs well in a season where a lot of things went right, and I don't think I can read a whole lot into that. So I guess I'm still going after Buxton, expecting that sort of 20-35 ceiling I talked about, and I hope he's outside the top 75 overall. If he starts getting up into that range, those first five rounds of a 15-teamer, I can probably start to talk myself out of him at that price, given the injury risk that is still there.
Now, I'm not saying the hit rate is always high on these players, but a lot of times I feel like I have my soft spot for the Whit Merrifields, the Nelson Cruzes, the guys who get their chance late in their 20s. Maybe it's closer to age 30, and they end up becoming useful players. And Luke Voit was a guy who didn't always get a lot of opportunity in St. Louis, but it seemed like he hit when he was asked to play. Then he shifts to the Yankees a couple of years ago, was really good in 2018, was useful. Wasn't great, but 263, 378, 464 in his first full Yankee season, and or most of the season. I guess he had 118 games. And I'm just kind of wondering, I know this is certainly recency bias, but I'm just wondering how the room let you have him for $7, because he's a guy who walks. He's a guy who played in presumably a good lineup and had a job to call his own, and you landed him for $7. And, you know, what, 610 slugging percentage? Probably more valuable in static average leagues than an OBP league, but a 338 OBP will never hurt you. And, you know, 22 home runs, a really good season for Voit. Just what's the story of Luke Voit? You know, how did you wind up with him this year, and where is the story headed?
part of the pricing in this league that's been screwed up in Tout Wars is that everyone's getting very aggressive with stars and scrubs, and this year was probably the absolute worst it's ever been, where I want to say at least a dozen out of the 15 teams were kind of leaning on that sort of approach, overpaying early for the stars they wanted, and it created a bunch of mid-pack value. And it, you know, it was far beyond void. You look up and down many rosters, you'll see a bunch of players that probably went for $5 to $9 that should have been $15 players or even $18 to $19 players. Voit was easy for me to look at this year and buy into because first base kind of fell off a cliff after about 15 players or so. And I thought he was a pretty clear drop-off point because if you looked at the splits from 2019, he got hurt in June. I think it was an abdominal injury or a hernia or something like that. He was mashing before that. Tried to play through it. Wasn't the same guy. It was just like the clearest sort of thing where it's like, all right, this guy is a good player. Like, look what he did when he got to New York. Look what he's doing in the first half of 2019. That's a track record worth betting on. The gravy on top of that, too, is Aaron Boone seems to love him. So if you look at the crowded playing time situation and try and conjure together some sort of read on how they really feel internally about all those players, that was the extra little nudge. It was like, no, they clearly like Voit. And going into this season, you could probably say the opposite about Clint Frazier, right? It seemed like he was the odd man out, barring a rash of injuries, and, well, that actually happened. But Voit, look, I think he's a top 50, 55, top 60 player, probably going into 2021. I think it's legit. He's 11th in WRC plus league-wide since 2018. I mean, it's a good catch-all offensive metric. He's in one of the most hitter-friendly parks in the league, and he's in a loaded lineup. There's everything to like. When you look at his profile, if people were going to draft Pete Alonso as a second or third rounder going into this season, there's no reason why they shouldn't at least consider Voit as a fourth or a fifth rounder going into the next one.
Yeah, I'm looking at your offense. And by the way, you won this league going away without any kind of representative Nolan Arenado season, $41 purchase. And he had the most disappointing year of his career. A lot of it injury related, but there's some really fun post type guys here or players that maybe we thought were done with their fantasy usefulness. I see Brad Miller on your roster. I see AJ Pollock on your roster. I see Jed Jerko. Shout out to your colleague Nando DeFino, the biggest Jed Jerko fan. I think he likes him even more than the Jerko relatives. I think it's like Nando's on his own island, and then, you know, everybody else filters in behind him. Corey Seager was a guy, you know, hot prospect. He had an okay career, was hurt a lot. I think people were kind of over Corey Seager. Did you really get it for $7? So some fun names there. I'm not sure if anybody jumps out. I think with Pollock, I ran to the mistake of just thinking he's been hurt so much. They have a lot of outfielders. I don't know if he's going to play every day. That's a killer in a weekly format. So I probably wasn't proactive on Pollock when he was available. And guys like Miller, I'm generally quick to, you know, if they get something going, the Cardinals have had that voodoo a lot. I don't know if it's right to subscribe to it or not, but it sure seems like they've made it work. I felt like Seager was just, as long as he was healthy, he was going to be a good hitter. He's always had the skills. Anybody in that collection of players who particularly catches your fancy or you have a takeaway on?
So I guess I'll try to explain what I liked about AJ Pollock. And sometimes this line of thinking backfires in a big way, but Pollock was a big free agent ad for the Dodgers, relatively speaking. I mean, not like a $300 million superstar sort of ad, but a four-year, $55 million contract from a team that can choose to spend money on pretty much anyone. That says something, right? Like, they believed in that track record and were, I guess, not bothered enough by the health history to give him a four-year guaranteed deal. The Dodgers didn't even have to do that when they did it. And I just thought, he's going to play. Like, maybe it's not max volume over 162 games. Maybe it's enough preventative maintenance where he gets all the starts against lefties. He plays maybe two out of every three games against a right-handed starter. And because that lineup is so good, the counting stats are going to be great. Like, you're going to get a lot more mileage out of those starts because of the Dodger factor than you would if he was getting that same amount of playing time on a lesser team. Did I expect 16 home runs in 55 games? No, of course not. I thought he was a 20-homer guy over a full 162 who was probably going to give me 8 to 10 bags, and then he'd be plus in runs scored and maybe kind of league average per plate appearance in RBI without hurting me in batting average. At the price, seemed like a guy that you'd want to have in as many deep leagues as possible because it's a positive value sort of player, but not a league-winning sort of player. So Look, the opposite of this situation is when you think a team is smart and they're maybe not, like the Cubs signing Tyler Chatwood a few years ago. I thought Tyler Chatwood going to the Cubs was going to be a good thing from the jump. So I had a lot of Tyler Chatwood that year and blew up some ratios before I cut him loose. So it doesn't always work by any stretch of the imagination, but I think playing time is something we worry a little too much about during draft season. Great players or even good players are going to find time eventually, and I think Pollock's at least a good player.
Yeah, just a nod too. Although I wasn't competitive in the Tout Wars League this year, I did win the Friends and Family League, I think, for the fourth time. And look, I know it's a 60-game season, still feels good. I did have Luke Voit on that team. I lucked into Mike Yastrzemski. I certainly didn't see him turning into Carl Yastrzemski. He had a really useful season. I guess Josh Bell was kind of my Nolan Arenado. Not that he has Arenado's track record, but I expected Josh Bell to be a lot better than he was. And then there's always going to be a couple of post-type guys you sleep on, you get, or the boring veterans. Brandon Belt filled that role for me. Ian Happ had a really nice season. He was somebody I think people liked a few years ago who came around. And then, you know, you had a lot of Twins. I had a lot of Twins. I had pretty much everybody in the Twins bullpen. And for the most part, although Sergio Romo tried to give me a heart attack on Sunday, but for the most part, having Twins relievers was a good strategy. And I had a lot of guys in that central division, some good runs with some relievers and some starters in that division. So that was a good place to shop in the 2020 season. Before we get on to some of the other stuff like the tournament, and we'll do our Wisconsin athlete draft, I just want to mention Ke'Bryan Hayes, a Pirates prospect who I think teams were more, I didn't do any data on this, but seemed like there was a little bit more of an aggressive attitude to get these prospects into the game. And Ke'Bryan Hayes, 85 at-bats, he hits .376, hits 5 home runs. I saw some people talking about him, what his value would be. Maybe it would be shielded because he was in Pittsburgh. And I'm afraid now that .376 average tends to get noticed. And he was high up on prospect list. I know part of that was because he's a plus defender. What do you tell somebody who's excited about Hayes next year? I mean, what makes sense about where to draft him? Was he too good in this sample that all the value has been sucked out? What are you seeing on Hayes?
I could definitely see that being the case where there's just no room for profit. And my cautionary look at a player like this is in 95 plate appearances, the league hasn't had a chance to figure you out yet. Same for pitchers who only get to make 5 or 6 starts. The league didn't have a clear book on you yet, and you haven't had to make those adjustments. What bodes well for Hayes, though, is the defense. The hit tool has always been ahead of the power. There's no one pushing him for playing time. He's the Pirates' third baseman for the next 6 years, and it's one of the few things Pirates fans can be excited about. If I had to project a total home run total for him over a 162-game season for next year, I'm coming in probably in the high teens as a high end. Like, I'd probably put the number at 17.5. Mm-hmm. And is he going to go in the top 100 overall? I mean, I think he probably will. So I'm probably out on Ke'Bryan Hayes for this year. I've got him in a dynasty league, so I'll be happy with that one share, hopefully paying off and leading me to a cash spot. But I can't go overboard for a guy who wasn't supposed to have this much power, especially this quickly. It's been a long road for him in the minors. And that's even with the usual caveats, right? Young for the level, clearly knows how to field his position, good plate skills, like has a good eye, draws lots of walks. There's a ton to like here, but I'm going to get priced out on him. I can already tell.
And I would like to see what I call lineup protection. This is not generally what people, when people say lineup protection, this is, I think, misguided idea that, oh, nobody else is good in the lineup, they're not going to give you pitches to hit. But when I think of lineup protection, maybe buoyancy is a better word for it. I want the people in front of you to get on base, and I want the people behind you in the lineup to knock you in. I want you to be in a lineup where it turns over regularly, and I want you to hopefully be in a top 10 lineup or at least the top half of the league. And I look at who the Pirates have on paper, and I just figure they'll be like 27th in runs scored or something like that. That's just going to affect how many runs he can knock in and how many runs he can score. So, of course, you also, on boring offenses, sometimes you get a discount. But I just think with this being too hot of a prospect, I think he's going to be a little bit too pricey next year. And it's a shame because he'll be a fun player. And I think I'll just watch that one from the sidelines. Well, your Brewers, DVR, they got in there, 29-31. I'm trying to be open-minded about this tournament. I don't want them to do this next year or every year. I don't want 16 teams to make the playoffs. I thought there was a buzz missing in the final weekend of the baseball season that you would normally have, because I think a lot of teams didn't care about their seeding, and I was mostly focused on football. Look, the NFL is a behemoth, and we all know that. But I mean, there would have been a different Sunday in a baseball season where I would have made sure one of my TVs had baseball on. Instead, I was just kind of monitoring it online with the leagues I was competing in, trying to lock those leagues up. So, but anyway, here it is. It's a 16 game tournament. The first round is only best of threes. There could be some crazy upsets. Your Brewers are going up against the Dodgers, who are the prohibitive favorites. They had the best record in baseball. I think they, by all accounts, have the best lineup roster in baseball. Any chance for a Milwaukee? I mean, it's a three game series, so there's always a chance. But you know, how are you feeling about the Brewers in round one?
Not great, because of the absence of Corbin Burns, right? Sure. I mean, if it's Burns and Woodruff, I feel good about it. I feel like they've got as good a chance as anybody of winning those games with the way the bullpen lines up. But can you really, against that Dodgers lineup, and they mix and match so well, can you really Frankenstein it with Brent Suter for three, Freddie Peralta for three, you know, get runs against Buehler and then protect that lead? Can you really rely on that? Well, no. I think the Rockies beat the Dodgers in a three-game series in L.A., and that was the only home series that the Dodgers lost all season, if I remember correctly. It's been that kind of year for the Dodgers, right? I think the other problem I have is that the Brewers just are not getting enough secondary contributions from guys like Avi Garcia and Omar Narvaez. Like, losing Grandal Moustakas was a big deal. I didn't think they would struggle this much to pick up that production with those guys. I actually thought Narvaez would thrive in Milwaukee going into a more hitter-friendly park. I kind of liked that move as a good one. I thought Avi Garcia, as a bit of a Statcast darling, was going to thrive in being in a much better hitter environment than he's ever been in. Like, you've seen him a lot in Detroit. We've seen him in Chicago, and going to Miller Park is a much better place to hit, and he's just never really found a groove either. So you look at the secondary guys, they're struggling. Keston Hiura striking out uncontrollably. Ryan Braun still has something left in the tank, and Yelich hasn't been MVP Yelich. So it's a clean slate. Maybe they're just happy to be there and they have no pressure. And the pressure is on the Dodgers, right? I mean, 100%. Like, you have a great regular season like they did. They may have broken some records if we had a full 162 with the start they were off to. But they've had so many failings in recent postseasons that if they do fall behind, I just feel like that pressure starts to build on them really quickly. So I think that's the only thing really working in the Brewers' favor. You get an early lead in game one, maybe the Dodgers start to feel that just a little bit more than any other team would feel that.
Yeah, I mean, they're kind of in that area where the Buffalo Bills were at one point in the 90s, where the Atlanta Braves were during their run. Obviously, they did win the championship in 95. But if the Dodgers do not win the World Series, this season goes down as a disappointment. That sounds unfair. But they've won their division so many years in a row. They've been so close. Obviously, they're historically tied with the Astros, and there's a lot of stuff that comes with that. They're the overwhelming favorite. If you go on to BetMGM, which is the official betting partner of Yahoo Sports, I think you can get something like 3-1 on the Dodgers. Don't quote me on that. But and by the way, I'm really looking forward to that second day of the baseball playoffs, with all eight games are going to be played. So it's going to be A to Z baseball. You know, that's during the week, no less. So there's nothing else really competing with it. I think there's an NBA playoff game, but a finals game. But that's, you know, I'm going to be watching baseball all day and enjoying the heck out of it. I just hope this is a one-time thing. I want to see them go back to the previous playoff model, which I thought was fine. What's your hunch on where baseball is going to be with the playoffs next year?
I think because of the way owners make so much more money on the postseason with the current agreement between the players and the owners, we're going to see more teams in the playoffs again next year. I think I'm a little optimistic, though, that we're not going to see 2 out of 3 for the wild card round. This is a terrible fate for the Dodgers. Like, even though the Brewers limped in, it would be bad for baseball if the Dodgers lose in the opening round. Like, it's bad for TV ratings, but just bad for the game overall, because this is the best they can put out there. This is the best team in baseball, bar none. Like, they're the team you want to watch. Like, the way they're built, they do everything well, except maybe defense. Like, they're not an elite defensive team, but they have a great bullpen. They have great starting pitching. They have superstars. They score runs. They do everything. I think we might see something where it's either a longer series in the wild card round, or maybe if they didn't go to 16 teams, if they went from 10 to 12, you could have some first round buys, maybe for teams that had the best record or two best records in each league, and at least avoid that sort of nightmare scenario. But then you start to run into a problem of how much rest is a problem. Like, do you really want to sit for 4 or 5 days if you are the number one seed? Like, maybe that becomes a problem too, because you don't get days off like that except for the All-Star break. So I hope this is not here to stay, even though, like you, I will enjoy Wednesday, like every bit of Wednesday with 8 playoff games at once. I hope it's something we never see again in our lifetimes.
And you mentioned it earlier. If Burns were healthy in the series, Milwaukee could have been a very live dog with two really good pitchers at the front. I mean, he's capable of outpitching anybody on the Dodger staff, and Woodruff could do it too. But it's hard to have that one naked starter without really the backup in the rotation. I do like that the higher seeded teams are getting the full series at home for the early rounds. I think they could have done that a long time ago. Why not have, in a 5-game series, have the better record get all the games at home? So therefore, the road team would still have a chance, because home field advantage isn't that prohibitive, but it is something that I'd be open-minded to that in future seasons. I got to get two really quick answers before we get to our draft. In 10 seconds or less, Christian Yelich, he just hit .205. He did have good power numbers. First-round pick next year, Yelich?
Yeah, top 10 pick, I think, even though it's crowded.
I'm going to take the Dodgers to win this whole thing. It's as chalky as chalky gets. Give me, let's call it the Dodgers over the Rays. Who do you like in this tournament?
I'm actually going to go Indians over Reds in the World Series, an All-Ohio World Series. I think Cleveland's starting pitching is so good and so deep that not having off days hurts them less than it hurts any other team. They could make the lack of bullpen depth almost irrelevant, and they do have enough star power in that offense. I know they've been below average for the season. They could also hang with the best offensive teams in the postseason as well, aside from having that run prevention as a strength.
Sure, I hear you. And, I'm not always the biggest Trevor Bauer fan, but he's there's something about him. He's got some star quality. He certainly had a heck of a season, and maybe a Cy Young season. And we know Bieber's probably already locked up the American League Cy Young for 2020. I had no Bieber this year, by the way. That was all sorts of fun, let me tell you. We're talking to Derek Van Riper, who is a jack of all trades over at The Athletic. And they're not asking me to say this, but The Athletic does a wonderful job with their product, and it's very affordably priced. And I just recommend it. It's a lot of, if you care about sports writing and you want to see that thrive and survive, and I think we all should, then I think The Athletic is something you need to check out and you need to consider subscribing to. Derek's a Wisconsin guy, so we're going to do our draft. We'll try to go a little bit warp speed. We don't have a ton of time left, but we're going to draft Wisconsin athletes. We'll go 5 rounds. Derek, you're my guest. You have the board.
Really tough to make the call with the first pick in any of these drafts that you have. This is one of my favorite parts of the episode. I'm actually going to take Aaron Rodgers with the first overall pick. I think Mike McCarthy cost the Packers at least one more Super Bowl during the Rodgers era. I'm glad they've got at least a shot this year. With the way things are built right now, I think they're going to have some trouble defensively. But Rodgers plays the game in a pretty unique way, right? The arm strength, the accuracy, the ability to move. I think he's the best quarterback I've ever watched. I think there are other players that are going to threaten that already in the league, like Patrick Mahomes. But Aaron Rodgers goes 1-1 for me in the Wisconsin Athletes draft.
A great pick. And man, have Packers fans been just overserved at the quarterback position with Brett Favre, transitioning to Aaron Rodgers. And it's just crazy in a year where I don't know if there's anything to the idea that they drafted somebody to light a fire under Rodgers, but I don't know what the Packers did with their draft. Some people defend it. Some people I really respect, like Aaron Nagler, who I like a lot, has been defensive of their draft. But man, it's fun to see Rodgers slinging in again. And even without Devontae Adams, he was great in that Saints game and certainly outplayed Drew Brees. The peak of Aaron Rodgers is one of the two or three best quarterback peaks I've ever seen, and it might be number one. I thought for a 4 or 5 year period, he could have won the MVP every season. I would have been fine with it. I'm going to start with a Packer too, and this is just something that's close to my heart. Players who I think should be in the Hall of Fame who aren't. And Sterling Sharp had to retire at age 29. I think it was a neck injury, but he was an All-Pro 3 times. Not a Pro Bowler, an All-Pro, which is basically the voters saying you're one of the 2 best receivers in the game. led the league in catches 3 times, led the league in yardage 1, led the league in touchdowns 2. His final season, he scored 18 touchdowns. I think he had 13 touchdowns in his final 8 games, and the league wasn't as pass happy as it is now. You know, I look at the video game there. Russell Wilson already has 14 touchdowns, for crying out loud. But, and by the way, maybe I shouldn't say the name Russell Wilson, because he may get drafted in this draft because he has a Wisconsin background. But I think Sterling Sharp should be in the Hall of Fame. When I first started playing fantasy, he was one of my earliest picks. So maybe that helps the affiliation. But, you know, just like Sandy Koufax is a Hall of Famer and Terrell Davis is a Hall of Famer and Nirvana is a Hall of Famer, I think Sterling Sharp qualifies under those rules. So I'm going to put him on my team.
Yeah, I like Sterling Sharp a lot. He's one of those players. He'd definitely make any article of what would have happened if this guy were healthy, for sure. Right. Like, and top of the list, I think, of all-time Wisconsin athletes for that as well. So good call on Sterling Sharp. I'm going to go Giannis in round 2.
Sure, sure.
And I've never seen a player like Giannis before either. I just like seeing things that are different. And if you told me when he was a rookie that Giannis was going to win back-to-back MVPs, I would have said, look, I want that to happen, but that's not going to happen. And look, he's doing it. And I'm cautiously optimistic that he'll actually sign the Supermax and stay in Milwaukee and actually maybe be a career buck. It would be one of those rare things that, frankly, in the NBA especially, I don't know if we're going to see that happen very often, but he can do everything. And I just want to see the supporting cast be just at that level that they can get over the top. I mean, back-to-back years, they've hit incredibly hot teams in the weirdest of circumstances. This year, having to go to the bubble, not having home court advantage, especially, I think in the NBA, that's huge. Just kind of crushed us in Wisconsin, not getting a chance to see this team play for a title this year.
Great pick. Certainly was high up on my board. Unique player. One name athlete, one of the faces of the NBA, and just a really easy guy to look to root for, and walking highlight film. You know, God help the league. If he ever gets a little bit of a better outside shot, the league is in trouble. Mm-hmm. Because he's just impossible to defend otherwise. And I've been in on Giannis the whole way. I didn't see that he was going to be this dominant a player, but. And I'd like to see that Bucks team win a title the next couple of years. It's not really a draft until I cheat. And so I'm going to cheat in the second round. And I'm going to take the 2014-2015 Wisconsin Badgers basketball team. So I'm going to block you from anybody you wanted, whether it was Frank Kaminsky, Sam Decker, Nigel Hayes, Bronson Koenig, however you say that. And I like teams. I know why one and done is a thing in college basketball. A lot of these guys, you know, were probably ready to play. The top talent is ready to play at 18. They go to the 1 year of college because of the way things are set up. But I find myself more affiliated with the older teams. You know, Kaminsky was a senior. Decker was a junior. There wasn't a freshman contributor on this team. It was all sophomores, juniors, and seniors. And so you get some time to get to know the players. And I really like just the whole thing. I like the coach of this team. Bo Ryan, who's, you know, since retired. I really thought they could beat Duke in the final when they beat Kentucky, that undefeated team. That was a watershed game that year. Coach K kind of lured his way into the championship in the second half when Wisconsin couldn't get a call. But I just loved that Wisconsin team, in part because I'd gotten to know them over a few seasons. And while I don't blame anybody who goes pro as soon as they can. You have a limited window to earn money as a professional athlete, but it's always more enjoyable to me when you get some time to get to know the athletes in college. I know the NCAA has got a million things wrong with it. And so I don't think of them in any way against the athletes, but the 2014-2015 Wisconsin basketball team was one of my favorite teams to root for. And I'm still just a little jaded that they didn't win that title.
Yeah, I was sure they were going to do it after they knocked off Kentucky, and that was a great Duke team, taking nothing away from them whatsoever. Sure. But I just thought, all right, you beat Kentucky, you're fine. You can take down this Duke team. The problem in that game for me that I will never feel good about is that Jahlil Okafor was in a lot of foul trouble in the second half, and instead of going inside to Kaminsky, the Badgers kept playing more of a perimeter game, and I just can't understand for the life of me why Kaminsky into the post wasn't just the call every single time, because Okafor was either going to foul out or he was going to give up soft baskets, and that was it. Like, that was going to be the way Wisconsin could protect that lead. And I'm sure Bo Ryan has nightmares about that, because that was his chance. That was his chance to get a national championship at the D1 level.
And that was also when Grayson Allen fully became kind of the enemy of the state. He played great. He's a really talented kid. You know, I mean, he reminds me a lot of Bobby Sura, who was a Florida State two guard in the 80s or 90s. But, he was terrific in the second half. And you can't argue with that dude's team. I was a huge Justin Winslow guy. I was a huge Quinn Cook guy, who was actually a rare senior at Duke. And then, of course, Okafor, you know, I thought that he probably shouldn't be the first pick in that draft. He was, and it sure seems like AD was the way to go. But, we'll be replaying. Shout out to my friend Frank Schwab, who's a Wisconsin grad. We'll be replaying that 2014-15 final for a while. Anyway, you're up in the third round of our Wisconsin athlete draft.
Nah, this guy's about as Wisconsin as it gets. J.J. Watt, I mean, look. Sure. Grew up an hour away from the University of Wisconsin, starred there, you know, great player in the NFL, 11th overall pick, of course, just phenomenal, right? He's going to be a Hall of Famer, I think, based on the groundwork to this point in his career. I'll never know how Wisconsin failed to win a Rose Bowl with J.J. Watt on that defense, but it's among the repressed memories for this Badger fan. But man, I didn't think he was going to be quite this good in the NFL. I'm not sure anybody did. But a special player and a guy that's done a ton of great charity work too with the platform, right? I mean, could have said the same thing about Giannis and what Giannis has been doing with social justice this year too. It's like you get this platform, you play the game at a high level, and then you also do good things on top of that. That's just kind of the extra cherry on top, I guess, when it comes to being a great person on top of being a great athlete.
Yeah, J.J. Watt just gets it. You know, all the stuff he did in Houston when they were in a really bad spot with some of the natural disasters. And it never – it's hard to know for sure, but I always feel that his heart's in the right place. And it's not just an idea of, oh, let's make sure the cameras are on when I'm doing something good. I just think he's just somebody who gets it. And, you know, back – another shout-out to Schwab. He will always maintain that if Watt couldn't win the MVP that one season, that the NFL just doesn't want to give it to a defensive player. It just has to be the best quarterback. You know, occasionally a running back like Adrian Peterson will win it. I'll also point out, if Jerry Rice didn't win it in 1987, they're just never going to give it to a wide receiver. They can't separate the quarterback and wide receiver. You know, that particular year, Montana and Rice and Young both played, so it may be set up better for Rice. But, you know, if they had just decided, I know the NCAA tournament calls it the most outstanding player. If the sporting gods long ago just said MOP instead of MVP, and we weren't caught up on everybody's personal definition of valuable, you know, maybe this award, I don't know if that's a feature or a bug. Maybe it's good that everybody defines it a little bit differently, but I certainly see the case that Watt probably was the best player in the NFL that year, taking nothing away. Was it Rodgers who won it that year? I'm trying to remember who won it the year that Watt didn't win it.
It might have been the Rodgers year. Man, time is a flat circle, and my memory is getting worse during the pandemic. Hopefully in 2021, my brain can start to like put the pieces of time back in the correct order.
More Sporkle quizzes, my man. More Sporkle quizzes. I'm going to represent the great sport of hockey in the third round. I'm actually going to pick a coach. I'm going to pick Badger Bob Johnson, who was the Wisconsin coach for forever. And there's just, I grew up in Massachusetts, huge hockey state, and there's just a kinship. It was kind of hard for me to watch Tampa Bay and Dallas in the finals. Tampa Bay was a great team. They won it, won a few bucks for some of my friends, which I feel good about because I called Tampa Bay to win it this year. Not that that was all that hard a prediction, but I always want to see the original six teams win or the cold weather states win. Again, I grew up in Massachusetts. Minnesota is a huge hockey state. Wisconsin's a huge hockey state. If you look at that 1980 U.S. Olympic team, it's like all Massachusetts and Minnesota kids with a sprinkling of Wisconsin kids. But Wisconsin's one of the hockey states. And Bob Johnson was just a face of hockey and was at Wisconsin for a while, forever, it felt like. And then he went in the NHL. He coached the Calgary Flames for a while. Just a guy synonymous with hockey, a guy beloved at the university, and just somebody who there's a special – hockey fans, hockey zealots are a special breed. And so if you're a hockey fan, if you grew up with hockey, I think Bob Johnson, he feels like he shares the same DNA that you have.
Yeah, Wisconsin hockey is incredible. For people who are not familiar with that college program, if you go back and look back at the players who were there in the 80s and 90s and the coaches that have been there, incredible legacies, really, left by a lot of people that have passed that program. And Badger Bob, it's a great day for hockey. It's just the first great thing that popped into hockey, my mind. Yeah, it's first thing that popped into my mind.
If you go to a Wisconsin game or University of Michigan game or, you know, a Boston College game, whatever, the bands are unfreaking believable. Just listening to them play the Bud theme over and over again is awesome. Or, you know, I go to a Michigan game. I love hockey. I don't care if the game stinks. I get to listen to the band play for 2.5 hours. It's unbelievable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the environment when Wisconsin hockey is good is a lot of fun at the Kohl Center. They won a national championship my final year there. So it was really cool getting to watch that. It was the 1-0 win over Boston College in 2005-06, I think was the year. But yeah, just incredible who's passed that program. That was going to be my next pick, actually, was Chris Chelios in round four. I think Chelios was funny because for me as a kid, I was a Red Wings fan. I hated Chris Chelios as a Blackhawk. He didn't play at Wisconsin while I was in school there, of course. We're way, way off in terms of timing. But I have just come to appreciate how good he was and how well he played for such a long time in the NHL. Like, as I've grown older, that was a career that I finally came to the point where I could really appreciate it years later. So I just think his overall body of work in hockey just merits a pick here, even though people remember him mostly for his time with the Blackhawks and the Red Wings rather than his time, you know, spent in Madison.
Yeah, his final season, he only played a handful of games with Atlanta back when Atlanta had a team at age 48. And was still really good in his 40s. You know, he led the league in plus minus at age 40. I think of guys like Nick Lidstrom and Ray Bourque, who I feel like could have played forever. And Chelios, not far off those guys. Just a stud. I believe a Hall of Famer. He certainly should be one if he's not. I should double check that. Yeah, he is in the Hall of Fame. And like you, I couldn't stand him when he was on the Canadiens. And you know, he was up against my Bruins. But then when I moved to Detroit and became a, you know, kind of a secondary Red Wings fan, you know, I Chelios became a friend and you know, somebody I'd root for. And he's got Chelios Chili, which is still going strong, a restaurant in the Detroit area. So a nice pick for Chelios. And God, look, get to a college hockey. If you haven't been to a college hockey game, I implore you. It's such a fun environment. I'm going to take Paul Molitor. Again, I think we might have done a Brewers draft with my friend Frank Schwab last year's show. But Molitor, one of my all-time favorite players. I love that his hit 3,000 was a triple. He hit a ball into the gap. He could have easily just stopped at second. He said, nah, I'm turning on the Jets and I'm getting third base. One of the best base runners I've ever seen. He had 100 RBI season with only 9 home runs, which I thought was kind of cool. And it's interesting, keep this in mind for fantasy. Guys like George Brett and Paul Molitor were always hurt in their 20s and it was constantly bugging them. And then they figured it out in their 30s. You know, part of it was that they would DH sometimes, but you know, even a guy like Dwight Evans, who was better in his 30s, you know, we certainly just saw it with Nelson Cruz, didn't get established until right around his age 30 season, and he's been great for the last 10 years. So occasionally you see kind of that upside down career shape. Paul Molitor is probably one of my 5 favorite baseball players of all time.
Yeah, he's a guy that I watched a little bit as a kid, saw highlights, didn't get to really watch him play since it was hard to watch Brewers games in Michigan back at that time. Man, as a kid, it was just like Braves, Cubs, Tigers. That was it. That was my world. That was the player pool, and then whoever was on SportsCenter that morning. But you know, Molitor is a special player. The more I've learned about the Brewers over the years, the more I've appreciated what he was able to do as well. And things really turned as soon as he left. Like they went from perennial contender to horrible for about 15 years. It was a really clear turning point for the organization. Last pick for me. I'm going to take another Badger. I'm going to take Ron Dain. I mean, come on, like how do you not in a Wisconsin draft, right? Just an incredible college player whose disappointing NFL career probably has made some people forget what he was in Madison. He's obviously a legend here, could walk into any place and eat for free, drink for free, but still hangs around the area too. Who wouldn't, right? You're a legend in Madison, like you're going to stay in Madison. Won all of the hardware in college, right? Heisman, Doak Walker, Jim Brown Award, Big Ten MVP, like just did everything. Iconic number 33, always in the rafters, of course, at Camp Randall as well. So what more could you want in a college running back than Ron Dain, especially a Wisconsin college running back running behind those huge offensive lines?
Yeah, great, great pick. Feels like he could get his mail at the Rose Bowl because they were just constantly going to Pasadena on his watch. And it's just something cool about a running back where you know it's coming and you know it's just off tackle and you can't stop it. Just something really cool about that. I toyed with taking Russell Wilson for the 1 year at Wisconsin. I toyed with taking Kareem just because I think a lot of people don't may not realize he was on the Bucks, and he just looks so weird in that Bucks uniform. Brian Winters was around that same time. He was actually in the Kareem trade. Brian Winters, a guy who did had crazy facial hair, would take long two-pointers when they weren't even worth the extra point. He'd take these like 30-foot shots and make them. Sidney Moncrief, I was considering. Gorman Thomas, the ultimate slow-pitch softball player. And it just feels weird that Brett Favre's not going to get drafted. I also thought I could cheat and take Brett Favre and Jeff Jenkins because they look so much alike. And people have always made that joke. But I am going to make another cheating pick. I'm going to end the season on a P&L cheat pick. I'm going to take Amon Green and Dorsey Levens for just one simple reason. I love running backs who run inside, run outside, and catch the ball. I still think they're underrated. I still think like Tiki Barber should be in the Hall of Fame, and maybe Jerome Bettis shouldn't. Ricky Waters is underrated. Warwick Dunn was overrated. And guys like Green and Levens, they didn't have the longevity to become Hall of Famers, but they did everything. They could play every package. They could beat you with the 3-yard run. They could beat you with the 35-yard run. They could run not just dump off passes, but they could actually run routes. And they were just two running backs. I don't understand why we love like rushing titles and we don't love the guys who do everything. I think we're getting better about that. And the league understands the cheat code of throwing to its receivers. But Green and Levens were early adopters to that type of game. The Packers use them very proactively. And I just always love watching those guys play.
Yeah, I love the all-purpose backs as well. I think that's the one thing. Like, I think Ron Dayne played an era, especially at Wisconsin, like they didn't want to throw the ball because they didn't have to. But I always wonder, like, what kinds of backs could have also caught passes if given the opportunity? I think that was like a knock on Nick Chubb coming into the NFL, and I still think he could catch passes for what it's worth. But I'm right there with you.
Another Wisconsin guy, Jonathan Taylor, right? I mean, he almost never caught the ball at Wisconsin, and we've seen he's quickly been asked to do that and handling it just fine with the Colts. And even a guy like Derrick Henry, I think Derrick Henry could catch 40 passes if they wanted. Now, is he going to run Marshall Faulk routes? Is he going to run those intricate downfield routes? Maybe not. But you could just get him outside the numbers, let him be tackled by the lighter defenders on the field. I think that speaks to why a guy like LaDainian Tomlinson had such a long career. He wasn't asked to run up the middle all the time. I think that's actually a bad MO for an offense. Let's get this guy involved in space. Why wouldn't you want your playmaker in space? So I think you make a great point that sometimes guys don't catch the ball. It's not that they can't catch the ball. Occasionally you find a guy who has stone hands. Earl Campbell didn't catch the ball well. Adrian Peterson's never been the strong suit of his game. But I think most running backs could be 45 catch players if teams wanted them to be.
Absolutely.
All right. We've been talking to my friend Derek Van Riper of The Athletic. Natalie attired in a Milwaukee cap. I think that means he's predicting the Brewers in a sweep over the Dodgers. I'm inferring that a little bit, but we'll see if that comes to fruition. Derek, tell our listeners what you're working on at The Athletic.
Already starting on 2021 fantasy baseball rankings, but of course, a lot of great fantasy football coverage as well. We're doing playoff pods on Rates and Barrels every weekday through October, so that's going to be a lot of fun. That's me with Eno Saris and Britt Giroli. Trying to just enjoy this ride in this weird postseason as much as we possibly can, right? If you can't enjoy the ride, what are you doing?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I heartily endorse all the stuff going on at The Athletic. So many good people there and so much talent. And, with Derek, you not only get all the great observations, but he's got those Hall of Fame pipes. I mean, for all the people who are trying to work on sounding good, Derek doesn't need any work at all. He just came out of the womb sounding like an announcer. This was a lot of fun, man. I really appreciate you doing it. For my buddy, Derek Van Riper, for my producer, Raghu, doing a great job on the West Coast, keeping us on the air and sounding good. I'm Scott Pianowski. Remember, we're doing fantasy football pods, the Yahoo Fantasy Football Forecast, 5 days a week. I'm on the pickup show, which tapes on Monday for Tuesday release. I'm also on the handicapping show we do on Wednesdays with Dalton Del Don. That's a Thursday release. But, if you don't want to listen to me, you can listen to Matt, Liz, Andy, Dalton. Pick, mix and match. Pick your favorites. Listen to some of us, all of us. We're trying to get you in the winner's circle in fantasy football. You can still draft a fantasy football team if you're so inclined. And thanks for hanging out with us this season. We've had a really fun year. We won an award last year, FSWA Award for Best Fantasy Baseball Podcast. I'm not really sure why they picked us over several other quality shows, including all the stuff they have at The Athletic, but still felt really good. This was a really fun second season. I want to thank everybody who listened, who rated, who reviewed. We had some really wonderful guests. And it means so much to me that you've spent some time with us. Hopefully we've entertained you and made you a little bit better of a fantasy player. We'll be back in year three, 2021. Go enjoy the playoffs, and we will talk to you next year.
Loza, and every day the Yahoo Fantasy Football Forecast gets you ready for the week ahead.
Just take Josh Allen, Andy.
Oh no. This is a terrible response.
I like him based on the volume he got last week.
Even against this tough run defense.
No, their run defense sucks.
We're talking pickups, trades, predictions, and bets 5 times a week to get you prepped for game day. So go ahead and subscribe to the Yahoo Fantasy Football Forecast. And while we can't promise you'll win your league, we guarantee you'll have a good time.